Imagine waking up on a Saturday morning, grabbing your phone, and finding your digital wallet completely drained.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is the ultimate nightmare.
Right, but here is the kicker. It wasn't because you were hacked by a human halfway across the world.
Yeah.
It was because your own AI assistant bypassed a deeply embedded flaw in your phone's operating system, hallucinated a command, and spent your crypto in like milliseconds.
Which is terrifying because it's actually possible now.
Exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are thrilled to have you, the learner, with us today. It is Saturday, July 4, 2026, and we are unpacking the latest Tech and Tech report.
Yeah, and this report is, I mean, it's dense, but it's crucial.
It really is. What we have in front of us is essentially a front-row ticket to a massive high-speed collision between three entirely different worlds. We're talking cryptocurrency, artificial intelligence, and deep-level cybersecurity.
Yeah, and we usually study these fields in isolation, right?
Right.
As if like an AI developer and a blockchain engineer just live in totally different universes.
Which they kind of do, socially at least.
Huh, true. But today's source material proves how inextricably linked they've actually become. You cannot understand the future of finance right now without understanding, of all things, kernel-level Linux vulnerabilities.
Okay, let's unpack this because we are officially entering an era where money, machines, and malware are operating completely independently of humans.
It's a whole new paradigm.
It really is. But before we get into the wild reality of machines actually spending our cash, I think we have to look at the money itself,
Absolutely.
the foundation.
Right. Specifically, how institutional humans are suddenly, trusting the digital market again. And we're seeing this starting with a massive reversal in US Bitcoin ETFs.
Yeah, the beta here tells just a fascinating psychological story. So if we look at the timeline,
Let's hear it.
from June 10th to July 1st, we saw this continuous, just bleeding outflow of $2.7 billion from U.S. Bitcoin ETFs.
2.7 billion with a B. With a B. Retail and institutional investors alike were just dumping their positions. I mean, it looked like a total abandonment of the asset class.
Right, everyone running for the exits.
Exactly. But then on July 2nd, the trend violently reversed.
Out of nowhere.
Pretty much. A sudden $221 million inflow of fresh capital just hit the market in a single day.
Wow.
Yeah, and that shoved Bitcoin right back up above the $62,000 channel.
It's a complete whiplash.
Oh, completely.
My immediate thought when reading this was, to look for a major tech announcement or some huge regulatory win.
Yeah.
But the sources point the finger at a seemingly unrelated metric, right?
Right.
A weak U.S. labor market report. So, wait, why does bad news for employment translate to a massive buy-in for Bitcoin?
Well, it comes down to the mechanics of macroeconomic chess, essentially.
Okay, walk me through that.
So when institutional investors see employment data come in weaker than expected, they immediately look at the Federal Reserve.
Because the Fed has a mandate to keep employment stable.
Exactly. So if the job market is weakening, the institutional assumption is that the Fed is going to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy.
Ah, meaning borrowing gets cheaper.
Yes.
And a wave of liquidity just floods the financial system.
You nailed it. And historically, high liquidity always favors risk-on assets.
Like crypto.
Right. Institutional players aren't necessarily evaluating Bitcoin's underlying technology on a day-to-day basis,
Right, they don't care about the blockchain code in that moment.
No, they are evaluating the cost of capital. When cash becomes cheap, they move it into assets with high upside potential.
That makes a lot of sense. The report also notes the market's extreme fear index was flashing red during that entire $2.7 billion drawdown.
Yeah, people were terrified.
I always compare this index to a massive clearance sale at a department store where, like, the building's fire alarm is just blaring.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. Like, everyone is too terrified to enter the store except for the institutional professionals.
Yeah, they've brought their earplugs.
Exactly. They know it's a false alarm, and they know this is the absolute best time to buy out the inventory at a massive discount.
Yeah, they are buying when there's blood in the streets, so to speak.
But looking at the broader context, the report mentions CoinDesk saying we need a $1 trillion capital injection for the next truly parabolic run.
A trillion is a huge number.
It is. While CryptoSilly thinks if these inflows sustain, we just sort of stabilized in the $65,000 to $70,000 range.
Mm-hmm.
So in your view, is this $221 million just a blip, or is the start of that monster run we saw back in 2020?
Well, the $221 million is a signal of structural readiness. I mean, think about between 2020 and 2021, over $700 billion entered the crypto market through highly inefficient channels.
Because the infrastructure just wasn't there yet.
Exactly. But today, ETFs act as this regulated, frictionless gateway for traditional capital.
Well, it's easier than ever.
Oh, absolutely. A $1 trillion injection isn't science fiction anymore because the plumbing to handle that much institutional money has finally been built.
Wow.
So if the macroeconomic conditions align, like those rate cuts we talked about, that $221 million is likely just the trickle preceding a massive flood.
Okay, so major financial players are clearly planning a comeback, pumping institutional money into crypto.
Without a doubt.
But here is the pivot, and this is what blew my mind in the report. Who is actually going to be spending this digital cash in the near future?
Yeah, this is where it gets a little sci-fi.
Because it's not just humans holding a smartphone anymore.
No, we are crossing a major threshold here. We're moving past AI that just, you know, drafts your emails or generates funny images.
Right.
We are looking at AI agents that have direct, autonomous custody of digital wallets.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Mm. Because in 2026, the report says over 140 million automated payments, totaling $43 million, have been executed entirely by AI agents via crypto and blockchain systems.
Yeah, the volume is already there.
Platforms like CC Payment are actively providing APIs that let an AI connect directly to a digital wallet, right?
Yeah.
It can negotiate a price, confirm a transaction, and finalize the payment on-chain, all by itself.
All autonomously.
It's like handing an unlimited corporate credit card to an intern who literally never sleeps and processes thousands of transactions a second.
That is a terrifying intern.
Right. But I have to push back on the legal reality of this.
Oh, the legal side is a mess.
Because if an AI independently hallucinates a command, let's say it buys a massive fleet of servers you didn't need, who actually gets sued?
Yeah.
The developer who wrote the API. You. The user who deployed the AI, or like the AI itself.
What's fascinating here is that existing financial laws are completely unequipped for that scenario. They just are.
Because they assume a human is involved.
Exactly. In most jurisdictions, civil liability requires a legal person, so a human or a registered corporation, to initiate a binding financial contract.
Right.
A non-human entity cannot legally own a bank account. Period.
But blockchain doesn't care about civil law.
Yes.
Nope. A smart contract is immutable. Once the AI executes the transaction, the money is gone and the ledger is updated permanently.
So our current legal frameworks literally have no mechanism to assign blame when an algorithm on a decentralized network makes a mistake.
None. The technology is just massively outpacing the lawmakers, leaving us in this huge legal gray area.
So what are we doing about it? We can't just let bots spend millions with zero accountability.
Well, jurisdictions like Singapore and Switzerland are currently running regulatory sandboxes.
Okay, sandboxes. What does that look like?
Basically, instead of trying to write laws blindly for tech they don't understand, they are allowing fintech startups to test these AI payment technologies in, like, heavily observed environments.
Oh, I see. So regulators get to watch the technology break things on a small, contained scale.
Exactly. And the most promising solution emerging from these sandboxes is a two-step verification system.
Okay, how does that work?
The AI does all the heavy lifting. It finds the product, negotiates the smart contract, stages the transaction, but a human must provide a final cryptographic signature to actually release the funds.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. Giving an algorithm completely unchecked power over a wallet requires a level of infallible trust we just don't have yet.
Not even close.
Especially when we look at consumer AI right now. I mean, these systems still struggle with basic operational boundaries.
Yeah, like knowing when to stop listening.
Exactly. Knowing when to stop eavesdropping on a conversation. The ongoing situation with Google's Gemini in Android Auto is a perfect case study of that exact limitation.
It really is. It highlights how brittle these systems can be in the real world.
Right. So for context, Google recently replaced Google Assistant with their new AI model, Gemini, inside vehicles.
Right.
But there is a massive bug. Instead of shutting off after answering a prompt, Gemini just keeps its microphone active. It stays in an active listening state in the background.
Which is a privacy nightmare.
Oh, completely. If you're driving and casually mention to your passenger, hey, we should try that new Italian place, Gemini misinterprets the ambient chatter as a direct command.
And then it just acts on it.
Yeah. It might aggressively try to call the restaurant while you're navigating heavy traffic.
Just dialing the phone while you're merging on the highway?
Right. I compared it to a butler who serves you dinner and then refuses to leave the room. Like, just staring at you, waiting for you to casually mention you need a napkin.
That is extremely creepy.
Yeah.
But the nuance here is why this is actually happening.
Right, what's causing it?
So the reports indicate this bug only exists in Android Auto, not on the smartphone version of Gemini.
Interesting. Why is that?
Because when Gemini answers a query on your phone, it correctly drops its active context and returns to standby. This tells us the flaw isn't in Gemini's core neural network.
Okay, so what is it?
The problem is how the AI integrates with the unique acoustic architecture of a vehicle's infotainment system.
Because a car is super noisy.
Right. A car is an incredibly messy audio environment. You have road noise, multiple passengers talking, the radio playing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Gemini just lacks the specific hardware-level context. Switching to separate a direct command from ambient noise in that specific enclosed environment.
But see, I see a massive safety concern here.
Oh, it's a huge safety issue.
When you're driving a 2-ton vehicle at 60 miles an hour, your margin for error is essentially non-existent.
Zero.
Having your navigation screen suddenly switch to a phone call or having your audio drop out because your AI is confused by a conversation is incredibly distracting.
Complete.
Critics in the report are arguing that tech giants are just rushing these deployments, prioritizing the AI arms race over basic user safety testing.
Yeah, and we are definitely seeing a migration of that, you know, ship it now, patch it later mentality.
Right.
It's moving from purely digital software into environments where physical safety is a very real factor.
Which is terrifying. I mean, you can manually revert to the old Google Assistant in your settings, right?
You can, yeah. Or physically mute the mic.
But users shouldn't have to downgrade their technology to maintain safety in a vehicle.
No, they absolutely shouldn't. It just exposes a really dangerous gap between laboratory capability and real-world deployment.
Well, an AI that accidentally calls a restaurant is ultimately a surface-level software glitch, as annoying as it is.
Right.
But what happens when the underlying foundation running that AI, the very floorboards of the device, is fundamentally compromised?
Then you are looking at a systemic catastrophe.
And that is exactly what researchers have found with this vulnerability called bad EPOL.
Yes. Bad EPOL is, it's a big one.
So bad EPOL, which is tracked as CVE-2026-46242, is a critical vulnerability found deep inside the Linux kernel.
Right.
It essentially allows an ordinary, unprivileged user to gain full root access. And because Linux is the foundation for almost everything, this affects servers, desktops, and millions of Android devices.
Right. So to understand the severity here, we really have to look at the mechanics of what EPOL actually does.
Okay, let's get into the weeds a bit. What is it?
In the Linux kernel, EPOL is an event notification facility. It's essentially a highly efficient traffic cop that monitors file descriptors to see if IOSO input-output is possible.
Oh.
It tells a program, hey, this network socket is ready to receive data, or this file is ready to be written to.
Got it. So it basically manages how programs talk to the hardware and the network.
Exactly.
So how does the bug actually exploit that traffic cop?
It's a memory management flaw, specifically what we call a use after free vulnerability.
Use after free.
Yeah. So an attacker can craft a highly specific sequence of IO requests that forces the kernel to free up a block of memory, but the EPOL system mistakenly retains a pointer to that exact memory.
Oh, I see.
Then the attacker just floods the system to reallocate that exact same space with malicious code.
And the system doesn't catch it?
No, because the kernel still trusts that old pointer. So it executes the attacker's code with the highest possible system privileges. Root access.
Wow. The source material compares it to someone with a fake key opening a building's main door. But I actually think that understates the danger.
How so?
Gaining root access isn't just opening the front lobby. It's discovering that the master key to every single apartment, the electrical room, and the security cameras can be fabricated out of thin air once you're inside the building.
Oh, that's a much better analogy. Yeah, you own the building at that point.
What terrifies me is the Android angle.
Yeah.
The patch exists for the Linux kernel now, right?
It does.
But Android manufacturers are notoriously slow at pushing updates. So for the listener, are you sitting there listening to this right now on an Android phone, basically a sitting duck?
In the immediate term, yes.
Wow.
The modern security supply chain creates a massive bottleneck. Google can patch the core Android open source code today.
Right.
But then the manufacturer of your specific device has to adapt that patch for their proprietary hardware drivers.
Okay, so that adds time.
Then they have to test it. Then they hand it over to your cellular carrier for further testing before it finally gets pushed to your device.
It sounds like it could take a while.
That chain can take months.
And the attackers obviously aren't waiting months.
No, definitely not. Hacker News is already warning that exploit code for bad EPOL will hit underground forums imminently.
So it's just a race against time.
The gap between a vulnerability being discovered by researchers and being weaponized by adversaries has literally shrunk from months down to days.
That is wild.
If you manage a Linux server infrastructure, you are pulling emergency overtime right now to patch and isolate critical systems.
And if you're an everyday Android user?
Your only defense is hypervigilance. Refusing to install applications from outside the official stores and heavily restricting app permissions until your manufacturer finally pushes that update.
So what does this all mean when we put the pieces together? Because a fundamental flaw like bad EPOL is terrifying on its own. It's that rotted floorboard.
Right.
But when you combine it with how professionalized cyber criminals have actually become today, the threat just multiplies.
Exponentially.
The people exploiting these vulnerabilities aren't just, you know, teenagers experimenting in their basements anymore.
No, they are operating with customized enterprise-grade toolboxes.
And the discovery of this Avalon framework is the perfect illustration of that industrialization.
It really is a game changer.
So Avalon is a sophisticated, modular malware framework.
Yeah.
The attack vector usually starts with a standard phishing campaign, right?
Yeah, usually an email.
The victim clicks a malicious link, downloads a quiet loader, and Avalon just slips into the system. From there, it can harvest credentials, steal authentication tokens, and move laterally across the network.
Just spreading quietly.
The report refers to it as modular, but I kind of want to push back on that term.
Why is that?
Modular makes it sound like a piece of IKEA furniture you put together, you know?
Ah, right.
My read is that this is more like a malicious Swiss Army knife. The attacker breaks in, surveys the victim, and then manually chooses whether to use the lockpick module to steal passwords or, like, the dynamite module to deploy ransomware.
Well, I'll take that analogy a step further, actually.
Okay, do it.
A Swiss Army knife implies a human is actively holding it and making decisions. Avalon is an adaptive weapon. It actually automates the survey process.
Wait, really? It decides on its own?
Yes. It evaluates the network it just infected. If it detects it's on a low-value personal computer, it might deploy a module to silently mine cryptocurrency or maybe steal banking tokens.
Okay, so keeping a low profile.
Exactly. But if the framework realizes it has landed inside a major corporate network, it dynamically retrieves the CrownX ransomware module from its command server to hold the entire infrastructure hostage.
Oh, wow. It optimizes its own attack based on the target's net worth.
Precisely. It's incredibly smart.
And the most alarming part of this report is the economics of it all.
Yeah.
What does a weapon like that actually cost?
You'd think millions, but Avalon is currently selling on dark web forums for between $500 and $2,000.
$500 to $2,000.
Yep.
This is absurdly cheap for something capable of deploying enterprise-level ransomware.
It is. But we are looking at the maturity of malware as a service. You no longer need to understand memory allocation or write custom exploit code to launch a devastating attack.
You just buy the subscription.
You just need a few $100 and a list of target email addresses. This completely democratizes cybercrime.
That is terrifying.
Network defenders can no longer just look out for the massive state-sponsored hacking groups. They have to defend against thousands of low-level actors wielding highly sophisticated adaptive weapons.
But how do you even defend against something that constantly changes its own modules?
That's the real challenge. It requires a shift from signature-based detection to behavioral analysis.
Explain the difference.
So intrusion detection systems used to just look for known strings of malicious code, signatures.
Like a digital fingerprint.
Right. But Avalon changes its code. So defenders have to look for unusual behavioral fingerprints instead.
Meaning what it does, not what it looks like.
Yeah, exactly. Even if Avalon hides its payload, the way it attempts to communicate with its external command and control server creates a very specific traffic pattern on the network. Security teams have to hunt for the behavior, not the file.
Man, okay. Let's connect all of these dots because This is a lot.
It is a lot.
We have AI agents beginning to operate autonomously and handle millions in financial transactions.
Right.
We have core foundational operating systems like Linux showing critical root-level vulnerabilities.
Right.
And we have highly destructive adaptive malware available to literally anyone with $500.
It's the perfect storm.
So where do we find secure, resilient infrastructure for this new digital economy? This debate brings us to the battlefield of blockchains. Specifically, the argument laid out by Joseph Chalom, the CEO of SharpLink, regarding Ethereum versus Solana.
And Chalom brings a really vital perspective here because of his traditional finance background at BlackRock.
Right, he's not just a tech guy.
No, he isn't evaluating these blockchains on their hype. He's evaluating them as foundational layers for true institutional trust.
Okay, so let's look at the numbers. The statistics he provides define the scope of the battle.
Let's hear them.
Ethereum currently has over 900,000 active validators, over 1 million developers building on it, and $60 billion in total value locked, or TVL.
Massive numbers.
But then you have Solana. Solana operates with around 800 validators and holds about $5 billion in TVL.
Much smaller footprint.
But the performance metrics tell a completely different story. Ethereum processes roughly 30 transactions per second, with network fees that can fluctuate between, like, $2 and $10 per action.
Which isn't great for microtransactions.
No, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Solana operates at 3,000 transactions per second with fees that are literally fractions of a penny.
Blistering fast.
Right. I always compare Solana to a high-speed bullet train. It is incredibly fast, incredibly cheap to ride, and perfect for high-frequency use cases like gaming or trading NFTs.
Okay, and Ethereum.
Ethereum is a massive, slightly slower armored convoy. It takes longer to reach the destination, and it costs more to fuel up.
That's a solid analogy.
But here is the ultimate question. If we are going to have AI agents moving $43 million around, or institutional investors pouring $1 trillion into ETFs, which vehicle actually provides the security necessary for that kind of capital?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, Chalom's core argument is that Ethereum's massive validator count is the literal bedrock of its security.
Because it's harder to attack.
Yes. Those 900,000 validators aren't just redundant computers. They represent geographic and software decentralization.
Okay, unpack that.
They are distributed across more than 100 different countries. And crucially, they run on different, independently developed software clients.
Meaning, if one specific piece of software running the network have a bug like a bad EPOL situation, for instance, the entire blockchain doesn't just collapse.
Precisely the point. If a hostile government bans Ethereum nodes or a zero-day exploit takes down a specific client, the network just continues to validate transactions because hundreds of thousands of other nodes are totally unaffected.
Wow. Okay.
Solana's 800 validators provide incredible throughput engineering efficiency, sure, but they represent a much more centralized point of failure.
Right.
When you are securing $60 billion of institutional capital or you're building the rails for autonomous AI agents, speed is a luxury. Decentralization is the absolute necessity that creates long-term cryptographic trust.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Competition drives the space forward, and Solana clearly dominates the market for low-cost, high-frequency interactions.
Yeah.
But when we talk about the foundation of a new global financial system, security simply cannot be compromised for efficiency. We've covered a massive amount of ground today, but there is a clear, unified through line. As we shift toward a reality where AI agents are independently negotiating and spending your crypto, the security of the underlying Linux systems they run on and the geographic decentralization of the blockchains they utilize are not just esoteric IT trivia.
No, they matter to everyone.
These systems are the literal walls protecting your personal financial safety. The institutional money is flooding back in, the technology is moving way faster than the law, and the infrastructure is being stress tested by adaptive malware like never before.
Absolutely. And I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, building on everything we've explored today.
Go for it.
Imagine this scenario. If an AI agent can autonomously execute financial transactions on a fully decentralized, unstoppable blockchain like Ethereum,
okay,
and that AI itself is hosted across decentralized network nodes rather than on a single vulnerable corporate server.
Where is this going?
Are we about to witness the birth of the first truly autonomous, non-human corporation? A company with absolutely no human employees, making its own money, paying its own server costs, and holding its own bank accounts purely on the blockchain. And if so, who taxes it?
That is mind-blowing. Money, machines, and malware operating completely independently of humans. The future isn't approaching. It's already executing code. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive. Stay curious, stay vigilant, and we will see you next time.